Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
So, how are you, Rob?
I'm feeling like a disruptor.
Wow, okay. Is that a good feeling to feel?
I don't know if it's a good feeling, because obviously being a disruptor brings many challenges with it. Mm. But I've been thinking a lot about this word, disruptor, and I have a big respect for those that aim to disrupt the structures of society and shake things up. And I feel like the artist we're going to be talking to today does just that. He is filled with a kind of precision and focus. And I think his work is analysing, you know, structures within society and hopefully making a positive impact on the world, and both visually but also socially. So yeah, I've been feeling very inspired while researching.
Amazing, Rob. What a great guest for Talk Art. How exciting.
Yes.
Well, we would like to welcome to Talk Art,
Troy Mitchie.
Thank you for the introduction.
Of course. How are you, Troy? Where do we find you and how are you feeling?
I'm good. It's a little tense in New York right now, but I live in Sunnyside, Queens, but my studio is still in Bushwick, Brooklyn.
Can you get to your studio?
Not at the moment. It is, yeah. It's kind of, I'm too freaked out to get on the train or anything like that.
Yeah.
So if I were to walk, it would be an hour.
And you're feeling the vibe there is pretty scary, or are you someone that's, are you quite like caught up in it more so?
I mean, I'm somebody who likes solitude. So right. I don't mind being indoors, but just going to do simple things. I mean, there's just a certain air when you leave the confines of your space. So right. I'm just working from my apartment. I'm still teaching, finishing the end of this semester through Zoom, and then just doing drawings.
Oh, wow, so you're teaching through Zoom.
Yeah, have you found that?
Yeah, it's difficult. So it's good that the graduate students already did their thesis in painting, and then we basically went to spring break, and that's when things started to intensify. So I've been distancing for a while, like since early March.
Wow.
Right. And you're able to work at home and on your own art. You're finding that okay?
Sort of. As a collage artist, it's difficult for me to only work with one thing. So I'm trying to go back to, I mean, I've been drawing since I was like 4 or 5. Mm-hmm. So I'm trying to go back to just that medium for now.
And what are you using to draw? Are you doing just pencil drawings or pen? Or?
Just graphite, yeah. And then I did bring a couple of like brushes to do ink wash.
Oh, cool.
But I'm not somebody who likes, I don't like having work in the space where I live.
Okay.
Right.
So that's difficult too.
Are you there by yourself?
Yes.
But you like to keep your work, your business separate to your home life?
Yeah, like I love going to the studio. I kind of treat it like another job, like 9 to 5. I work better in the mornings, and then pretty much by afternoon, I'm done for the day.
And do you have like, so do you have projects that you set yourself when you get to the studio, or do you get there and improvise with, because you would say in yourself just now, you're a collage artist. That's how fundamentally you will describe your practice, right?
Mm-hmm.
And, yes. And with that, what is the structure that comes with that? Or can you be free and play around with that?
I mean, it's definitely a freeing practice. I have a lot of my work is research-based. So there are moments where I'm not always making. So I'm either reading, watching films, listening to music, just kind of trying to get a certain grasp around all this knowledge. And then when I go to the studio and work, I do different things. So I have the paper weaving, so I'll do that for a little bit. I'll do drawings on the magazines, and then that'll switch to drawing with the sewing machine. And then kind of each material that I use is kind of built up. So whether I have to paint paper that then gets glued in, collecting objects. So it is kind of, I don't know, there's like a lot of facets to just getting to the point of being able to make.
Yeah. Well, let's break down every one then, because every one of them is very unique to your practice, and the fact that you integrate every single one of them into your pieces makes them so striking, so particular to you. So let's talk about the magazines, first of all, where you source the magazines from and what the images are that you're drawn to that you then collage into your works.
In the beginning, it was a friend who was giving me magazines. So I think at the time she'd go visit Portland, Oregon, and they, I don't know if this is true, but they had, I think, the largest erotic warehouse in the country.
Really?
Yeah.
I
don't know if that's true anymore, but I would just tell her what I was looking for. And it was just predominantly magazines that featured men of color, which are difficult to come across. So when I was using those...
Vintage ones or contemporary?
The vintage ones. So normally 70s or 80s.
What is it about that time?
There's an aesthetic to them. They're very interesting to look at just in terms of the layout of the pages. There's like a modernist type of design. Mm-hmm. And I'm really struck by the matteness of the ink. So they're not like super glossy, not super... I guess this is pre-Photoshop. There's just something about the men that feel real. Mm-hmm. That I feel is very different from magazines now.
But at the same time, I've heard you discuss this before, and you realized very quickly that these magazines were kind of born out of fetishism and fetish, and often made for like a white audience. So they're people of color, black, brown,
marginalized male communities. Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Definitely.
That is
a part of the... I think the interest in the magazine, one, comes from just growing up kind of in a smaller community. And kind of that was the way... I guess I'm an older millennial. So this was... I wasn't total... Like, we would have computer classes, but everything was still pretty much analog. So I sourced a lot of my pop culture from magazines, like going to the grocery store, the pharmacy, and then from television, mainly watching MTV when I wasn't supposed to.
you were born in 1985, weren't you?
Yeah.
And you grew up in El Paso in Texas?
Yes.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
What was that like growing up there then? What were these magazines you had access to, and what was the art scene like?
I don't know if I was really aware of an art scene as a kid. But the magazines, I don't know, I kind of credit El Paso for being a place where I just was actually living in this kind of collaged space, or like an amalgamation of different cultures, since it's a border town.
What does that actually mean, a border town then? Because I've come across that in your interviews.
Oh, it's literally on the south border between Texas and Mexico. So the Rio Grande River... is kind of the line which differentiates the United States from Mexico. Mm-hmm. But it's very weird because in El Paso, you can literally see Mexico when it's like a mile away. Like, I see the river, I see this territory that is allocated as something othered. But as a kid, there's just so much crossover. I think it's, I think I've heard it's like the largest binational and bilingual community. So there are often people coming in over the bridge from Ciudad Juarez for work. I went to school throughout my whole education with people from Mexico. And then I think my family, I grew up with my mom's side. I think they're like fifth generation Mexican.
Right.
So there was a lot of, I don't know, like there was no, everybody spoke in Spanglish.
Right.
I don't know, there was no, and I never had any sense that that was strange. It's also very highly militarized location.
Wow. So this is the collage effect then. I get it. So you are living in an environment where literally everything is crossing over and there isn't a definitive like language or a definitive race or a definitive style.
Mm-hmm.
It's like, so that, and that is definitely played into your work. Is there an actual literal wall there? Or is it like the bridge is the border, the water is the border?
There is a wall. So before, I remember as a kid, I mean, I haven't looked at images of that in a long time. It was like a chain link fence, but along that fence, there's border patrol station there every certain amount of yards, and they're there 24 hours a day. So it is a highly guarded border. And now there is, I believe, Bush built up this more intense wall.
Yeah, exactly. And obviously there's been all the politics more recently, hasn't there, with Trump? Yeah. And
definitely, which has been infuriating.
And I heard you speak before about this idea of the kind of lies that are associated with immigrants and the kind of unfair, you know, associations that are put on immigrants when actually a lot of the time it's not true. It's just for people's own political advantage.
Stereotypes. Yeah,
definitely. I mean, there's a certain type of, I mean, I think it comes from this idea of a fear of the other.
Yes.
But most of, in my experience, just living in this type of community, it's people that are just trying to have a better life, better families. I don't know, it's about survival. And there's just been so much misconception in terms of the media, but also, I don't know, I feel like El Paso, it's always been a pretty safe environment to grow up in, despite kind of all these ideas of like gang violence and drugs. And yes, that is there, but it's not like the broader story of that community.
So we've got the magazines as part of your collage with the vintage erotic in, and then we talked about the weaving, which is another key into your work, which always feels to me very crafty. Which I don't know if that comes, or where does that come from? Does that come from an experience of weaving? But you weave a magazine and paper together, right, to create like a background.
Yes, the weaving is new, and I think at first, well, not that new. So with, I've pretty much been only working in collage since grad school. Mm-hmm. And when I would get kind of at a place where, or just out of frustration from juxtaposing images next to each other, I would sometimes just weave certain things together as just a material. And some of those experiments surfaced when I started to do assemblage work on the wood panels. And I was in a show at the New Museum called Trigger Gender as a Tool or Weapon. And I saw this painting by the artist Nancy Brody Brooks. And there were these kind of grid-like paintings that were just called, I believe they were called protest t-shirts.
Right.
And then I realized like, oh, I don't really need, like the substrate that I'm using could actually just be the material. Because when you zoom into fabric, it is kind of a grid. So that's where the weaving comes from.
So you've gone like macro on it rather than micro?
Yes.
Oh, no, micro on it rather than macro, I mean. You've kind of zoomed in, and that's the quality we're seeing, this weaving, is as if you've got fabric and you've gone in times 10.
Mm-hmm.
That's cool. And then sewing as well plays into the work, and you actually sew, which I love, through paper and around figures and around the magazines.
Yeah, the sewing is new, and I actually don't really know how to sew anything, but I know how to do these settings on the machine, and I just use this as a way of mark making. And it's kind of just, I don't really know what's going to happen until the thread starts going through the pages. But I am enjoying it as just this kind of other material or component to add to the work.
Why do you think collage has become your medium, the Troy Michie medium?
I think it always was, and I just, when I think back to like early art education, I was really into drawing, and that led me into different avenues. Like I was thinking about architecture, because of drafting. And I used to love to just do portraits. And for some reason, I had convinced myself that to be an artist, you had to be a painter. So then I majored in painting. And I had been working with oils, traditionally pastels. But on my paintings, I could never just only paint. I would sew into them, or I would cut into them, kind of glue paper on the surface. Mm-hmm. And when I got to grad school and I realized that I could do anything I wanted, I like quickly was like, well, forget traditional painting, like, because I didn't want to do that anymore. Mm-hmm. And I've just kind of been just enthralled by the language of collage ever since.
And actually, even though you say that sewing is quite a recent development, you've had a reference to sewing previously, I think even in works from like 2016, where you had sewing patterns. And some of those works were like the first things that I actually saw by you. And I was really interested in this whole series of work that you made relating to the Zoot suit and the Zoot suit riots from the 1940s, like June 1943. Can you speak a bit about that kind of research part of your work?
Yeah, so that project pretty much came at the time of the presidential election. Mm-hmm. And I kind of was just in shock by what I was watching on the media, just kind of this harmful and problematic language to kind of, I don't know, it seemed like a way to kind of divide people. Yeah. And coming from this territory, it was just, there's a lot of people making assumptions about an area that they haven't lived in or experienced. So I had been thinking about trying to do a project about El Paso for a long time. And I just didn't know how to start without thinking about things that were the most, I don't know, evident. So when I think about home, or my family, I think about food, and I think about like, I'm not going to do like burrito collages or I don't know what, or Mexican flags.
You considered like, it though, right? You thought about it though, did you?
I did for a moment, and it felt too obvious. So when I was visiting home one time, and I was talking to my father, and he was telling me about the Zoot suit. Uh-huh. And it's something I had grown up knowing, just with the Pachuco culture, with low riders. I just never really, and I didn't realize that had originated in El Paso.
So what is the Zoot suit though? Because I think a lot of people listening, and I've only really discovered it through your work, is what is the Zoot suit, and why is it such a political item of clothing, like style?
I mean, the Zoot suit is kind of considered to be the first American suit, and it was pretty much furthered through jazz culture by African-American communities. They don't really know exactly where it originated, but I'm sure, like with the jazz craze of the time, like with Cab Calloway, the suit kind of started to appear. And it is, there's something so flamboyant about it, and totally. Almost armor-like, and also
like?
Dapper.
It's kind of like high-waisted, isn't it?
High-waisted pants, suspenders with a very low crotch, and then it tapers at the ankles. And then you have a jacket with a very broad shoulder.
Yeah, it's almost like shoulder pads, isn't it? And a kind of long, loose jacket. So the jacket's kind of very distinctive in itself.
Yes. Often they'd wear a hat with a feather. I mean, you can see examples in, if you ever have seen Malcolm X's, or Denzel's character as Malcolm X, they're wearing Zoot suits there, like Dick Tracy. I feel like that's a Zoot suit, the mask.
Got it.
I almost feel like Bugsy Malone and that kind of thing as well.
I'm thinking of the weasels in Who Framed Roger Rabbit. Do you remember all of those?
Yeah, they had Zoot suits too.
That was totally the Zoot suit. Got it. Okay, cool.
And by that point, it had become kind of so much part of popular culture in a way. But it originated in the 1940s.
Yeah, I think like 1939. And it had a short phase and then probably phased out by like 43.
Yeah.
So which was the time how does that play into your work? Yeah, and how does that play into your work and what are the riots?
I mean, I kind of took on this as a topic to research, and the more I started to look into it, the more it related to everything that I'm interested in. So it was an American suit that was predominantly worn by men of color. I liked that aspect. It was also worn by women who, at the time, because of the war, they were starting to go back to work, right? Have factory jobs. So it was kind of this, the first time that people were allowed to wear pants, and that kind of came into this idea of self-styling. So it did feel like it crossed over a lot of lines in terms of race, class, gender. And that's what I found most interesting.
Have you got a suit for yourself? Have you ever had one made or anything?
Well, you've had them made as part of your work, haven't you?
I did, yeah. There's a local tailor there, Mr. Alvarez. And when I first was doing research, I felt like I had to get a suit to just understand it. And I had one made for me. But that's been cut up.
Everything has ended up in your work? Is it back in your
in the art? Yeah.
Yeah. I had about four or five made.
Wow. And they've all been cut up.
Yeah.
That poor tailor, he's going to be like, where's the suit? I have to see you in your suit. You're like, yeah. Just go look at this picture.
Yeah, I haven't told him that.
So fashion plays a huge part in your work then, in your practice.
Kind of recently. The earlier collages were more about, thinking about a kind of disembodied state. So kind of being free from the things that signify, like a certain type of labeling on the body. But I encountered just using a black body, that body is always kind of racialized. Like, I'm not sure it has the freedom of being neutral. Just thinking back to the whole, the figure in Western art, and there's a certain type of, there's a distinction between like a nude white figure to a black figure. So I was always reluctant to add clothing because to me it signified too much. But when I started researching the Zoot Suit, it just kind of opened up this place where I'm at now. So it's been exciting for sure.
I found it really interesting when I heard that you'd had these suits made and then you kind of deconstructed them and not tore them apart, but cut them up. And this idea that somehow you've kind of analyzed the creation of that look, which became the title of these riots, which at the time there was obviously so many different race riots happening, but this particular riot wasn't called a race riot, even though it was, related to that, to race, but it was actually called the Zoot Suits Riots. So it's this interesting thing that like the clothes themselves were constructed and then that sort of takes over in the way that the communication is. I just found it really interesting.
Yeah, and that's kind of what ultimately led to me cutting into them. So it's because of World War II rationing and just the changing atmosphere in Los Angeles around that time. It led to basically these Mexican youths being stripped of their identity, which was the Zoot Suit, right? Because it had incited so much, animosity. And the suit, it was illegal to make the suit after a certain amount of time.
What? Illegal because to make clothing?
Yeah, because of rationing.
A certain suit.
Because in wartime, it was seen as excessive and kind of against American principles or something. Because
it like a gang affiliation as well with the
money
suit at some point?
Making
was
the suit.
Right.
I mean, it was both. At the time, the media was also kind of painting the predominantly Latino culture that was wearing the suit as a bunch of hoodlums or kind of up to no good. So that people were already thinking that, and I think there was a murder that had occurred in like 1942, the media had been using as kind of this like inflammatory propaganda.
Exactly.
So,
the murderer was wearing a Zoot Suit.
It was with some Latino youth, which I don't know if he was wearing a suit exactly or not. But I mean, it's called the Sleepy Lagoon murder.
Mm. Right. Yeah, and I mean, in those riots, like 500 Latino youths got arrested as well. So it was like, it was very much you know, kind of big social thing at the time.
Yeah, and they were arrested supposedly for their own protection.
Yeah.
And from what I had read, meanwhile, I think a lot of basically white servicemen off duty or living there locally were taking in taxis to kind of come in and deal with the, I guess what they were saying is the Latino problem. And there are a few photos, but I keep coming back to these images because you see just these young people on the ground, like their clothes stripped from their bodies. Yes. And just kind of just looked crazy. It was literally like total chaos during, I guess, that week of the riots from like June 3rd to the 8th.
Yeah.
Wow.
And actually, when you think about collage and the way that you're bringing together different images, I noticed that there's a theme as well of like camouflage in your work. And mm-hmm. you've often had photographs and images of zebras, almost looks like they're dying or maybe they've been attacked or something. But you kind of have this kind of parallel with nature in that way as well.
Mm-hmm. That came about with this project. So as I was thinking simultaneously of the Zoot Suit and the history and El Paso, I had just been looking at my own work during like the dreaded moment of residency applications when you're like, what is my work about? And I kept just thinking about this word camouflage, and I didn't really know much about it other than I grew up seeing that every day, like desert camo in El Paso. But I just started to research the whole history. And it was really interesting because I found out that artists really furthered that history. And I guess he taught at the Home Guard in England, but he's an artist, Roland Penrose.
So he was a
prominent player in camouflage theory and kind of developing tactics to show to the military so they could believe like in successful concealment. And there was also another artist, Abbott Thayer, who's kind of known for doing these like angel paintings. Mm-hmm. But on the side, he also was really like doing all these camouflage experiments with cutouts. And but what was also interesting is it was at the exact same time as the riots. Mm-hmm. So early 40s, like 1943. Mm-hmm.
So have they been an inspiration to your work? Have they inspired your work a lot?
I mean, not them necessarily, but I was interested. So in Roland's book, The Home Guard Manual of Camouflage, he kind of breaks down these different forms of camo, and one was called disruptive patterning. And I was really into that theory because basically, I guess the easiest explanation is the zebra. So that form of camouflage is not one that is invisible, right? Like it's like you're very aware of the zebra and its pattern, but yeah. when it's with other, I don't know how do you say multiple zebras,
zebras.
Yes. when they're in a group, and let's say like a lion is attacking them, the lion cannot see an individual zebra. It only sees like this mass of floating lines that are contrasting. They use that for razzle-dazzle camouflage for warships. So you could see the ship in the distance, but you couldn't tell its scale, like which direction it was coming.
And it's called razzle-dazzle camouflage.
Razzle-dazzle camouflage,
that's
yeah.
That's so camp. So what does razzle-dazzle camouflage look like then on a submarine?
It's just stripes,
or on a
like
ship.
These crazy black and white contrasting stripes at all different angles.
And actually,
and is
razzle-dazzle,
that where razzle-dazzle comes from? Is it what came first, like razzle-dazzle dancing, or showing the razzle-dazzle, or the camouflage?
I'm not sure. I only know the camouflage part of it.
But razzle-dazzle has appeared a lot in art as well, like through the generations, even in kind of 60s pop art and op art. I think there were certain
so like
people
Bridget
that were
Riley
inspired
would be described
by
as razzle-dazzle artist. Like,
I don't know, but I think she might have looked to it as something she might have looked at. I know that Peter Blake definitely did, and he's even made more recent kind of pop art boats he did one in the Merseyside. So it's kind of a theme you see, and it's also influenced music and albums and many different things. But the reason I was interested as well in this idea of camouflage was how it kind of applied to you personally. And I really resonated with something that you said about being queer and gay. You sometimes go outside as you're growing up and you feel like you might need to camouflage yourself. And I guess there's many different versions of that, you know, it's applicable to all different kinds of people, I guess. But can you speak a bit about that kind of personal element to it?
Yeah, I mean, when I started thinking about the project, I think in earlier works, it just felt very formulaic to try to add this, like a queerness as an element, or blackness, or Mexicanness.
Latin, yeah.
And I just realized I was already all of those things. So just, I could make anything, and that could still be a part of that dialogue. But I was just thinking back to safety, specifically people in the community that are even more marginalized. And just, I had been hearing so much about murders in the city of the trans community. And ultimately just thinking, I don't know, it's just, it's crazy to me that fashion can incite such animosity in someone's point of view. So I was thinking about just kind of the safety of, I don't know, just members in the community, but also just, there was something so like gay about this suit to me, and that it was extremely flamboyant. So I wanted to,
it was quite kind of queer, wasn't it?
Yeah. I mean, it is a very, people still wear this suit, and it is kind of, it could be a very macho kind of thing. So I wanted to just queer that history a little bit.
Yeah, definitely. And there's something about the exaggerated form of it as well. It's like this kind of
drop shoulders very, and everything, isn't it? Yeah.
It's very kind of, OTT. I've just remembered what the name of the album was. So there's an album from 1983 by OMD, who are like a kind of electronic band from the 1980s. And they had an album called Dazzle Ships. That was what was in my head a minute ago.
Ah, I see. Rob.
Yeah, and it was quite an influential record. When I was making electronic pop music, everyone used to talk about it. And
as like a reference. Quite an
interesting thing. Yeah. And also the plural of zebra is zebra.
Oh, okay.
Or zebras with an S.
Zebras.
Just in case listeners are wondering. But I didn't realize it's actually zebra as well. So it's singular and plural. Isn't that a special word? I love it.
God, Rob, you are just an education today.
Thanks. I feel like I'm Stephen Fry or something. Like.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Oh, so when you took apart your suits that you'd had made from your poor tailor, how did they end up in the work? Because I know that I've seen a lot of like leather belts, and there's metal zippers, and you have like shirt collars and cuffs, and then the rest of the shirt is kind of missing. How do you integrate these things into your collage?
A lot of them are my own things. So initially, I don't like to... I guess I throw things away easily, but I also want to make sure that they get recycled into something. So initially it was my own shirts that I didn't wear anymore, or belts or shoes or socks. And then I'll go to kind of thrift stores, and I just have this intuitive sense, which I've learned to trust more. And I just know when the work needs something, and it'll just be like, I need a yellow terry cloth shirt, or like, it's just like, I don't know how to describe it, but when I go to these kind of secondhand stores, if I see it, I know that it's something that could be integrated. The weirdest thing is sometimes I'll get back to my studio and I'm not even looking in specific sections, but all the garments are my exact size. Wow. And I'm like, that's weird. Like, you're literally just randomly grabbing things, and a lot of them end up being like my measurements.
So it's meant to be in some ways.
Yeah, but with the suit, I did wait for some time because I knew all the work that had gone into it. And yeah. I love Magritte. He's kind of like a guilty pleasure for me. Or maybe not so guilty, but there's a painting I saw of his that I believe is called Pascal's Coat. And it's this floating trench coat with all these holes in it, and this kind of night background. And I was like, okay, this means I have permission to cut up these coats. So that's why.
So who do you look at then? You're saying Magritte, but who collage wise? Who are the big artists? I guess Rauschenberg's in there, is he? And
he's in there for sure. But initially, when I started. Just only working in, I don't know, the medium or the technique. I was looking a lot at the surrealists of the time. Right. But I was really influenced by like Murray Oppenheim and Frida Kahlo, even though she's not technically one, there is like kind of an attachment with her to that movement. But I'm not the biggest Picasso fan. So I'm trying to think of others. There's like Georges Huguenet, I believe, was another collage artist. And then just looking at Dada, so like Hannah Hawk, John Hartfield, Kurt Schwitters, and then even kind of the, I don't know what, my French is terrible, the Nouveau Realisme, or the, there was like a group of artists, so it was like Mimmo Rotella, Jacques Vallée-Gley, and Francois Dufresne. So I was looking at a lot of those people early on. But then kind of like some of my biggest influences in making art were like Kara Walker, Lyle Ashton Harris, Wangechi Mutu, like her earlier collage work, and John Stesiker, who I was so happy to see that you all had interviewed him.
Oh, yeah. I've worked with him a bit as well. He's amazing.
Yeah,
he's so.
And what about
good.
About Matisse? Does Matisse play in? Because I think of the snail. I think of the colors of the snail, and I mean, he was when in his later stages, he became like predominantly a collage artist as well, right?
Yeah, and this body of work, I was thinking of Matisse in the sense, like, kind of his large gouache cutouts.
Yeah.
Yes.
And I'd been working primarily with color that I had found in the magazines, and then I was like, oh, I could just paint paper and add that in. So I kind of had not really thought about that until I saw his work in person.
Are they quite fragile, your works? Do you show them unframed or framed? How do they get protected? Because there's so many elements and there's so many pieces that they could be easily damaged, right?
No, they're pretty durable, and I'm not precious with them. So I work on the floor mainly, kind of like Jackson Pollock style. Like, I have this drop cloth that people think is art, but it's just literally kind of the area where I'm making all these things. So floor to wall, just so I can get a distance to see the works. But I use like a spray mount just to kind of get things down temporarily. What else? Sometimes hot glue, sometimes epoxy, and then everything gets sealed with an archival glue.
It does. So paint goes over the top of it. Right. So what is what is the dream? Where would you want to be like shown? What is the like for a collage artist? Where is the best place to have, or just for any artist, I guess? But where is the best place? What's the dream?
Oh my god. I don't know. I don't know if I've really thought about, I mean, to be included in the recent biennial.
The Whitney Biennial.
We loved your work.
Yeah, Russell took me to it. That's where I saw your work, yeah.
Standout.
That was so surreal. And just to be surrounded by, I don't know, just like really amazing artists that are working in collage, just historically. I don't know.
How did that come about? What was the process of that? Like a studio visit and
a couple of visits. So around the time with my first solo show at Company, I had I had known Rue Hockley a little bit because I'd done a residency called LMCC. And that's where I first met her. And she actually told me about this amazing book about Caribbean surrealists called Refusal of the Shadow, which I really come back to a lot. But so I'd met her then, like in 2014. Mm-hmm. And then she came to visit with Jane. And then it was just like a crazy year. So from that show, I had done a kind of an installation at Recess Art. And they came by to visit that. And I was like, huh, like they are coming to a lot of my things, but I didn't think anything of it. And then they scheduled another visit. And then they had basically come to just tell me that they would like to include my work.
Wow.
Yeah. But then it was, you had to keep quiet about it for some time.
Yeah, of course. Was it a game changer? Did you feel like after that things shifted?
I mean, in a way, I feel like so much change has happened really since that show at New Museum. Yeah. And that was kind of, at the time, I was already working on this new body of work, but I'm really happy. So a lot of times, too, I just throw things away. Like, I take them as experiments, like, don't need them again. But I hadn't thrown away those particular works. So when they asked to put him in this show, I was so happy that I had
it. You'd hung on to them. Of course.
So, I don't know, it's just been kind of a whirlwind. I really am happy with the gallery I work with at Company. Yeah, it's a great team. Yeah. I love that it's a team of women, reminds me of my upbringing. And the biennial as well. I mean, it's all just feels kind of surreal.
Can we talk a bit about your titles? Because I love the title of your show at Company Gallery that was called Fat Cat Came to Play. Mm-hmm. And a lot of your titles also seem to reference very personal kind of, I don't know, memories or maybe even locations. But can you speak a bit about how you title your work? And is that important part of the process?
I really don't like titling things.
Really?
It's, you know what it is? Because it almost feels like you have to... It's like the work shouldn't be defined, but with the title, it's somehow defined by that. But I realize I can't have untitled 1, 2, 3, like on and on and on. So when I get to titles, I really kind of just mine music and literature, because I think those are kind of some of my strongest influences. So Fat Cat Came to Play was just thinking about the language of the time, like kind of this 40s dialogue. So kind of a cat being like the jazz player.
Yeah.
But also kind of a joke on that song, Zoot Suit. I believe it's Zoot Suit Riots.
Yeah, yeah.
Is that the song? And then other titles, I look to this writer, Gloria Anzaldúa, who is from Texas as well and writes a lot about just kind of the landscape, being Latino. Poetry, and what else? Chavela Vargas, this famous Mexican musician. So they do come from kind of things that I kind of have gone back and highlighted in books or just songs that I listen to a lot.
Interesting. Because I find them to be very evocative, actually. Like they kind of conjure up very sort of poetic moods or something. Like I remember the title of your work called Pull a Comb Through Your Coal Black Hair, which to me just sounds almost like a poem in itself. Like it's just the most perfect sentence.
Where
did that one
come from? That one, I feel like that came from, that might have come from that song or a song, I can't remember which one specifically, but originally I wanted the show to be called Pull a Comb Through Your Coal Black Hair.
Yeah, it's a beautiful title.
Maybe, but I do look a lot to poetry. I know, right?
It could be like a retrospective in the future. And that work actually had movie posters in it, didn't it?
Yeah.
And flags and different things.
Yeah. So the really early on when I, in the research phase, I was buying a lot of memorabilia from that film Zoot Suit, which I had grown up seeing all the time as a kid. And that was kind of like a reference to John Stesiker with his film stills. But also when I was a painter, I was painting these large-scale movie posters for kind of B-grade horror sci-fi films, and then I was casting myself in them.
So what? I've always kind of, let's go back to this. What was you doing? Where were you showing these posters, or was this just your own personal project?
This was undergrad. So a lot of that work, I've just always been really into film. So like reading a lot of film theory and like photography theory, but just kind of the, I don't know, I loved just the design that went into these posters. And even
and
like
you would
the
paint yourself into the poster. You were there, your face was on it.
Yeah, so kind of casting myself as like as the other or as the Frankenstein or the monstrosity. And then I had kind of created these Mexican wrestler identities.
Did you have wrestler names?
Yeah, there was two. So there was one which was El Negro, and then the other one was El Pocho.
Who was the best one?
I mean, they were often fighting each other.
Yeah, so who won
these
most,
matches?
Though?
I don't know if anyone ever won. I think they just both got tired.
No one ever wins, really, do they? Yeah.
These
no
are the two parts
wins.
Of
we're
yourself,
all...
like, fighting
yeah, exactly.
like
battling it
yeah.
out.
It's still continuing. It's an endless battle.
Amazing. Mm-hmm. So what body of work really are we funny. Into now? Because the last thing that I saw was at work of yours was this mobile of... suits that you had at the Independent Art Fair this year,
yeah,
which is I think called the Invisible Man, was it, which is, again, is an amazing title. What where are we at now in your work and practice, and what is the next body of work we're going to see?
I'm still working with the zoot suit, but I am ready. I always have these kind of back burner projects and I allow them to just develop naturally, but I think now's the time to just kind of move to the next thing. So that's partially what I guess I'll be doing in this state of confinement. Right. Just kind of rethinking how I can move to the next body of work. But yeah, I mean, the zoot suit work has really just been amazing in terms of all the research that I learned. And that the book, Invisible Man, I always come back to. And when I reread it, I was shocked that there is kind of a little passage about zoot suiters.
Oh, really?
Yeah. So that's kind of, it just felt like everything that I kept coming across in research, it was like meant to be brought together.
The Invisible Man has a kind of political stance as well, because it's about like marginalized people or minorities in society are deemed invisible.
I mean, it is what I love about Invisible Man is the main character never really know who he is. He's just kind of the narrator, and it takes place in Harlem. And it is a complex novel in that it's kind of, it reminds me of kind of this, like, it talks about the difficulties of being seen, kind of like hyper-visible and invisible at the same time. But also there was a period where there was like a lot of African Americans kind of joining this Marxist doctrine. It kind of covers that part. And then I thought it was just amazing to bring up this idea of the zoot suiters. And I'm always thinking of this particular quote where Ellison talks about like these men being distorted in the interest of design, as just kind of a commentary on the outfit itself.
Got it. And do you think growing up working class has played into your work a lot? I think there was a quote I heard that you said that you thought because you're working class, you'd have to work twice as hard due to socioeconomic factors to get anywhere.
I mean, working class was definitely important, but my family, I just came from a family of hardworking women. So it wasn't kind of, it wasn't like you have to work harder because of your appearance. Just in general in life, if you want to get anything, you have to work for it. So there was this mentality that you can't really go anywhere, just kind of sitting on the sidelines. So I do feel like that was really influential for me. And to have their support. Yeah, they're not artists, but I do think creative in their fields. And maybe my mom too, she had me fairly young. So I grew up listening to a lot of music. And that probably was the another marker of collage. Like, we would listen to like Aretha Franklin and Al Green, and then like the Sugar Cubes and Depeche Mode and Spanish music. And it was just kind of, it was super eclectic.
And actually, that's what I like about your work, is that I feel like even though it's collage, when I first heard about your work, you immediately think of like paper. But I love the fact that you have like, you know, wire from fences, or, you know, wood or clothes or tables. You've got so many different materials.
Rubber gloves. But
rubber gloves, like sewing patterns, everything. But the fact it all sort of is, it's all kept together and tied together by this very kind of like rigorous intellectual investigation that you're doing. And I'm also really into the disruption. That's why I used that word in the intro. And the way that you kind of will hide images or you know, conceal an existing image and paint over it or cover it so that you can't interpret that image in the way that it was designed to be interpreted. And how did you start doing that part of it, the kind of like hiding what's there, almost like creating a new surface?
I mean, I think that's what I've always been drawn to with the history of collage. Like, it seems to have always appeared in these moments of kind of political upheaval, and just this inherent need to subvert. And that's, just the way that things are advertised. That was really important for me to kind of take what this meant, or to take things from the past, at least with the pornographic magazines, and try to bring them, kind of take narratives that are forgotten or just not brought front and center, and kind of give them a new life.
Right. Yeah, so you're repositioning the past, really. Yeah.
Amazing. Cool. Well, Troy, we ask every guest that comes on some very serious, hard-hitting questions. The first one is, if you could do an imaginary art heist, you could have any work of art in the world, whatever it is, from anywhere, what would it be and why?
I was worried about this question because it's hard for me to choose one of anything.
You can pick more than one. We're fine with that. Okay. We have big vans.
Big vans. I would definitely choose something from like the Russian constructivists, because they were really influential to me. So either maybe a piece by Malevich or Elazitsky. Then
what do they look like? Describe them for people listening.
I mean, they're just kind of abstract, geometric abstraction. I'm really drawn to that work. I don't know. I feel like there's a certain equilibrium that occurs even in the work of Mondrian.
Yeah.
I don't know. Like, I'm really drawn to that work at times. Who else would I?
I can see Mondrian in your weaving, in the making, the pattern making.
Like Sophie Tauber Arp. I'd really want a piece by Jean Arp.
Yes, a sculpture.
And then, Joaquin Torres Garcia. It's one of my favorite artists. It's kind of a Latin American constructivist. Also using kind of symbols and geometry. And then probably something by Mark Bradford. I mean, he's been, I don't know, like I really look up to his work and it's just so beautiful.
Him.
No, I think I would be too scared to meet him. But I really do love his work.
Yeah, he's
incredible. I guess he has a collage theme running through all of his work then, I guess.
Yeah, especially with those like Mimo Rotella and kind of the use of day collage.
Yes.
I think that would be, I don't know, I keep thinking like about Wilfredo Lam too.
I love Wilfredo Lam.
Yeah. I would really love one of those works.
He's either guy that's slightly great. Basquiat. He has a Basquiat kind of like line oil stick vibe going through the work.
I mean, there's a lot of things. When I was in Paris, I don't know if it was like last year or the year before, they had a whole retrospective at Pompidou.
Yeah, I saw that. I saw the same one. It was at the Tate before and it traveled to Paris.
Okay. I was blown away because I felt I would never see that show here in the States.
Yeah.
He's just sculpture, painting, prints, really prolific artist and amazing style.
I even love the early paintings that he did as well, like the kind of more traditional ones, you know, more self-portraits. I think he was Cuban, wasn't he? I was just thinking about Cuba because we interviewed Billy Porter, who's an actor, and he's been in Cuba recently buying art there. He's really into Cuban art.
Yeah, he's Cuban. I believe he was like half Chinese, half Cuban, but I'm not sure. But I kind of think about him a lot in my work.
Yeah, that makes sense.
And when it comes to style then, so who is there like a fashion designer historically or currently contemporary that you look to their clothing and think, wow, that's someone who's an artist in their own right that you'd like to wear?
Ooh, I don't know. In terms of style, I've always been told that I'm an old soul, and I just love kind of that look from the 40s, 50s, 60s. So kind of the silhouettes of the shirts and like high-waisted pants, the side parts. With designers, I like, I remember seeing like a Schiaparelli book.
Oh, wow.
And I really loved her designs. They're just super surreal.
Yeah.
And then contemporary, I maybe shop too much at Acne.
yes.
I'm trying to think of one. I know there are some, I'm just blanking.
Elsa Schiaparelli's like amazing.
Oh yeah. Love Schiaparelli, early Pierre Cardin.
Yes. I can see that. Yes.
I don't know. I just like kind of that more classic silhouette with a little like something that's unexpected.
Like original Christian Dior like vibe and
I also like the fact you were talking before about kind of vintage clothes as well and like, you know, sustainability on that level.
Mm-hmm.
That's kind of an old soul thing because I always like the idea of clothes, you know, sort of existing for a long time and going through different generations.
Mm.
Yeah.
So the other question we ask every guest is, what is your favorite color?
Ooh, that may be more than one too. I really enjoyed when John Steseker said midnight blue.
Oh, really?
Because as a kid, I was obsessed with that crayon, midnight blue. And I do kind of, I mean, I don't know if gray is a color because it falls between like an achromatic, but I do love kind of like a charcoal gray.
I like a charcoal gray.
I like yellow sometimes. Like it's always in my work. I have to fight it because I like it. But mostly blues. Blues or grays are kind of favorites that I come to.
Good to know.
Love that. So we also asked one more question because we're all in lockdown. Have you discovered a hidden quarantine talent that you didn't know you had, but since we've been locked down, you've realized you've got?
Not hidden, but I used to play music a lot when I was younger. So I've been trying to get back into singing and playing guitar again.
Do you write songs?
I used to, yeah. I just felt like I was a lot more emo or something as a teenager. So when I sit down to write, I'm just like, it just feels like too much. But I'm trying to enter that headspace again.
Interesting.
Mm-hmm.
What are you working to next? What's the next adventure for you?
In terms of my work?
Yeah.
I'm thinking a lot about the women in my family. So my grandmother passed away maybe about 6 years ago, and we were really close. And I kind of want to do something just to honor her. So a lot of my work still kind of comes back to like a place of family, like film, like narratives, or so I'm thinking a lot about that and kind of how I would often draw from her old pictures as a kid.
Right.
And then I'm not going to be teaching. So I got a Hodder Fellowship through Princeton. So I'll just be allowed to make work for the next year.
Oh, wow. Is that a fund due for a year?
Yeah, I've always worked while making art. And so this will be the first time that it'll be like in the studio 24/7.
I'm super excited. That's like a relief, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I'm really excited about it.
Congratulations, Troy. That's
I'm looking
brilliant.
Forward to seeing what the results are.
Thanks.
Of that.
Yeah, cannot wait.
Intense period of work.
Once this confinement ends, I can start to.
Although maybe now's a good time to read and like. Research yeah. and all that.
Yeah, I'm definitely in that phase now. But it does take time, and then it'll lead me to other things, and I'm just excited for what'll happen.
What do you think it's going to be like when we get out of this? What's your kind of impression of where the world's going to be at in the art world?
I mean, it's hard to say. I think the art world will be fine for the most part, but mm-hmm. it's just hard to imagine things going back to normalcy as they were. I just feel like things will be forever different. I don't know, but I really feel just so much gratitude that I'm safe, that I have an apartment, and I'm able to distance myself.
Yeah.
But it's hard to say, but I kind of just take small bites. Like I think a little bit about it, and then I distract myself with teaching yeah. or like reading or home workouts.
Good.
I need to take your guidance on home workouts because I'm useless. I just cannot get motivated. I've been so like doing no
You're
exercise
good at the reading
at
though, Rob. You're very good at reading.
Yeah, right. Well, it's been such a joy to spend this hour
Thank
with you.
Thank you, Troy.
Thank you so much.
Thanks for having me. It was nice to talk about the work.
Hopefully when this is all over, we can actually hang out in New York, which is where we were supposed to be right now.
Yes,
but
exactly.
Instead, we're all at our respective homes. But I'm looking forward mm-hmm. to meeting you in person. And thank you so much. For images of all artworks we've discussed today, we will be posting on our Instagram at TalkArt. What's your handle, Troy?
I think it's just Troy Mitchie.
Yeah, at Troy Mitchie. And we will link to him on our Instagram if you can't find him. So it's all sorted for you. And,
thank you, everyone.
We
Thanks, Troy.
Very soon. Thank you Thank for you. Listening. Thanks, Troy.
Bye.
Bye.
Bye. Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamant and Russell Tovey. Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in this episode. Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever you get your podcasts.